love you back. Stay tuned every Wednesday at 11:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 8:30 Pacific, with your host, Boyd and Lucinda, for the hottest talk show in existence. The streets don't love you back.
I gotta do right before they call me home.
Good evening and welcome to the Streets Don't Love You Back show. Today's November 9th, 2011. I'm your host, Lucinda, with my co-host, Boyd. And our topic is, as always, the Streets Don't Love You Back. Join us every Wednesday night with real people, real stories, and real changes as we hear the truth about gangs, drugs, violence, abuse, and other life issues. We have a great show for you tonight. We have Miss Teresa Joyce, and she's calling in all the way from England. She is the author of There's a Fine Line, and we're going to hear her story tonight and what made her write her book. Let me go ahead and welcome Boyd to the show.
We would like to just thank everybody for tuning in tonight. And like the missus said, we have the young lady all the way live from London, England. And she's here to tell her story and her message, and we hope that you truly get something out of her message tonight. And without further ado, we will pass the mic over to her, and she will formally introduce herself.
Good evening, both of you there. It's Teresa here. Nice to be on the show.
You're welcome.
Go ahead and let us know a little bit about you, Teresa, where you grew up, and just a little bit about your background.
Okay, I grew up in England, as I said, as I'm calling from. I moved around the country quite a bit because my parents moved around quite a bit. My real father was killed when I was 3 years old. My mother then moved back to her hometown because she had 3 children and needed the help of her parents to bring us up. My mother remarried again when I was 7 to my stepfather, and we moved to a different city where he was from. I left home just before my 16th birthday, went into the RAF. When I came out of the RAF, I got married, and I never actually went back into that family home. I'm not quite sure here. Do you want me to go into the reason I wrote the book here, or what would you like me to sort of, what would you like first is what I'm asking for?
Right. Well, go ahead and let us know a little bit about your mom's background and your mom and dad before he passed away. You know, as we talk about the cycle of violence, we, you know, always like to know where we know that it started, or at least what we know about it. And then just, just start your story.
Okay. My father, my real father was killed. He was an alcoholic, violent person to my mother. He spent time in a pub or seemed to think that his money was better spent other than feeding his wife and his children. My mum put up with a lot of abuse for many years. She tried to leave him at one point, but he sort of followed her, found her, and threatened to take us children away and that she would never see us again, which meant it was something she couldn't have dealt with. So she stayed within that marriage, living a life of hell, to be perfectly truthful with you. I was a month early because of a boot that was thrown into her stomach when she asked for money to feed us. I remember the day the police came to the door. Actually, I know I was only very small. I was only 3, but it was 2 policemen there, and they sort of said that my father had been killed. And I think the first words from my mother's mouth was "Thank God." I think she must have thought to herself it was her only escape. Those words are sort of etched into my memory, and the sort of reaction from the police when she said this. But she had an awful life with him. And then she had another sort of like 4 years trying to bring us up, 3 children, moved back to her parents. As I said, she worked 4 jobs to keep us. She did an early morning paper round. She worked in a laundry all day, fish and chip shop at night, and cleaning for a lady down the road when she came out from the chip shop, you know, till the years where she met my stepfather. He was in the Royal Navy, not his hometown, but it was sort of the town that where the Navy were actually stationed there. Was where she met him. As I said, she remarried when I was 7 and they moved up to Bristol. That was a union for me. That became a living hell for many years. There was abuse within my childhood, which was suppressed. I guess my mind couldn't deal with the issues there. I know 2 months off my 16th birthday, he said to me one day, if I continue to live under his, in his home, in his house, and I had to live by his rules, I could no longer actually live with any rules he imposed. I went down that day, got onto a bus and went to the centre of the city I was living in and joined the Royal Air Force. I sort of never really knew what I was running from then, because the abuse as a child had stopped when I got to that age, and I never really remembered at all until the abuse started again and encroached on my life as a married woman. That story, I guess, was something that it was some letters that he kept. I mean, there was also so much abuse you wouldn't believe. You know, I mean, this guy was violent. I was sexually abused. There was shotguns, and he threatened to kill people that I cared about if I didn't do what he said. He came to my house one day. He'd actually severed one of his fingers to give to me as an apology for the way he'd been behaving. You know, I mean, he was a crazed man. He would follow me to work, and he would wreck my car, and it had to, you know, it couldn't even be fixed. It was that badly sort of wrecked where he followed me to my place of work. He followed me everywhere I went. You know, every time I looked in the mirror, he's behind me, behind my, you know, my rear view mirror, I could see him following me. And I would sort of get 30, 40 letters a day through the post to me when I actually found the strength to stop this, because I allowed it to carry on for 4 years for fear of hurting my mother. She had such a hard life when she, you know, when she was a young wife, and then bringing us children up until she met my stepfather. Whatever else he was a good provider, and I suppose I could see that she was no longer struggling, and she absolutely adored this man and loved him so much, and she had no inkling of what was going on, and I suppose I allowed it to carry on for that reason. I couldn't break her heart. I couldn't wreck her dreams, because she'd never had, she'd had an awful start, you know, to her married life. She obviously was thinking now that this things had turned around and things were going to be good for her. He also threatened, as I say, my family, my son, my sisters, my brothers. They all worked for him in a company business, and he threatened their jobs. To know the actual intensity of all this, you'd have to sort of read the book, because I'm trying to condense it, you know, everything into a small space of time here, which is a bit difficult because there are so many things within that book. What have happened, it's, you know, when I actually sent it to my publishers, they thought it was a fictional book, but it's actually non-fiction, and it was my life. You know, I lived that. Eventually, when I found the strength to stop it, because I actually tried to take my own life where I got that low, and this is when he went to my mother and told her we were actually been having an affair for 5 years, which was so far from the truth, it's unbelievable, but he's very plausible, and, you know, up until the day she died, I don't know if she actually really believed that he was lying. Very, very difficult for me. I lost a lot of my family through that. Anyway, we'll go back to the abuse as a child and the recollection of that. When I actually found the strength to stop what was going on around me, he would put letters to the door. One day they would say he hated me. He would call me any name that you can come to mind. That was an awful, you know, a slut, a whore, all these things. The next day he would tell me it was undying love, and how, you know, he could live without me, and that he wanted me to run away with him. But within his letters, there was always a reoccurring phrase. He would always say, "You'll always be my little brown girl." And, you know, I kept reading these letters day by day and thinking, that means something to me, and I don't know why. Why does it mean something? Then the day came when the letter came through the door, and I read it, and I knew what it meant. It was like the dam bursting open. You know, these memories came flooding into my head. There were memories I thought weren't mine. They seemed alien. You know, I wouldn't own them. I didn't want to own them. And it was the abuse of my childhood that had been suppressed coming back into my head all at once that day. I would say now I probably remember 90%. I don't remember it all because, you know, but gradually as time's moving on, I'm remembering more. And the book, the writing of the book helped me with that an awful lot. It's very therapeutic, but it was also enlightening for me because whilst writing, there were more snippets of my past as a child coming back into my head, and I'm still trying to struggle to get 100% of that. I've spoken to people about this. I've been in and out of mental health care for many years because of the situation I was in. And they explained to me it was actually a trigger point, that the verse he was writing in his letters in the end broke through my conscience, my consciousness, and I remembered. But you don't want to remember. I didn't want to remember. I just thought somebody had put these memories there in place, and I'd been sort of, yeah, brainwashed, but I now know that it was the absolute truth, and these things sort of happened to me. So there's a big lump before you there. So, you know, crazy life I had for a long time.
So your stepfather was physically abusive as well as mentally and emotionally abusive?
To me, yes. Not physically, as he wouldn't hit me. He didn't beat me up or, you know, violently, but he was very sexually abusive to me. It was a case of anything he wanted sexually, I was blackmailed to doing. I felt as though I had no control over anything that... you know, because he would ring up and say that he was sitting outside a friend's house with a shotgun, and I had 10 minutes to get there to go where he'd asked me to go, because I'd refused previously, an hour before previously, and he was waiting for them to come out, and when they came out, he was going to shoot them, you know. And when I say this to people, you know, there's always this sort of breath taken back, as if he wouldn't really have done that. I know he would have done that, because I did get in my car, and I did drive there, and he was sitting in the car with the shotgun, and when I looked into his eyes, he wasn't even there. It was just like a void. It was like madman's eyes. And I had no doubt in my mind that he would have carried that threat out, you know. I mean, another friend, so the violence towards me as physical was never directed at me, as he didn't punch me or hit me. But he would, other people, you know, he went to a friend's shop that was very close to me and, you know, smashed a shop up and beat her father up and broke his arm, you know. And this is just because he thought that they were trying to... help me get away from what he was doing. So physically he did to other people, mentally and sexually he did to me.
I think sometimes the mental abuse is even worse, you know, that the controlling and he was controlling you using other people basically. But I think that's worse a lot of times. You know, the physical pain and the physical abuse you can, I think, overcome and get past sometimes, where the name calling and the emotions and things that go along with all the other is something that you never forget.
No, it's you know, this man was deranged. He probably still is. I think he's in Europe living now. I haven't seen anything of him for the last 15 years. It's taken me that long to sort of get my life back on track. Well, really, until 2 years ago when I started to write the book, and that was basically through... it took me a long time to find a psychiatrist that I could actually gel with, because I found my trust... I didn't trust anybody. I didn't trust... The only person I trusted was the person that looked back at me in the mirror every day, you know. I didn't trust anyone or anything around me, and it took me so long to find a psychiatrist that I felt I could over time open up to. And it was only by her saying to me one day, you know, well, you know, after a few years of seeing her, you know, if we can't get to see each other on a certain day and you're feeling this low and I can't get to the telephone, just write down how you're feeling, and when we next meet we'll talk through what you've written. And I did that for a short period of time, and it was sort of random words. They weren't any sort of, they didn't rhyme. There was no sense of. And this went on for a while, and I suddenly thought to myself, well, I'm making sentences here, and now I'm making paragraphs. And I sort of stopped one day and thought to myself, you know, this is really, really helping me. I'm going to stop. I'm going to start again, and I'm going to do it as a book, because I feel it will help me heal. And I knew, because of being within the psychiatrist sort of system, there's so many people out there that were suffering like me, that I thought it would help them too. So I had sort of two things in mind there. I wanted it to help me continue the therapeutic work through what I was doing and from writing the book. And also I knew that there were other people out there that needed to hear this story, needed to know that it doesn't matter how far you go down, there is always a way up. You know, there's always a light at the end of the tunnel.
Right, that's true. And now, how did you have two siblings?
Yeah.
And how did they get through all that? Did the same thing happen to them?
Well, you know, I've been asked this on many interviews. It was never... I asked my sister outright once, and it was sort of, no, it didn't happen, and it was dismissed. My brother, I don't think it would have been his thing, you know, because he was a boy. But, I mean, if I truthfully think about it, I just think it was me. I think when my mother remarried, there was something about him that I didn't like, and I was quite rebellious. And I think he took it in his head that I was the one he had to break, and I think he took that to extreme. I don't know how it started, but, you know, I've been asked as well, did it happen to you because you were the weaker sibling? And that's actually not the case. I mean, for this man, it was a case of the stronger one was more of a challenge. You know, he needed to have the fastest car. If he had a horse, it would have to be a stallion, you know, because the spirit was harder to break. So the answer to that is, I think it was just myself, and I think what I said about the being stronger and being more independent was also something he felt he needed to control.
Right, and as he controlled you, obviously he drove you into, I think, that mental health issue. Just dealing with that on a daily basis, how do you think that the way he treated you affected you mentally?
Oh, I was, you know, I've called the book There's a Fine Line, and I didn't know what I was going to call the book when I started to write it, and I didn't actually title it until I finished. And as I say, it's called There's a Fine Line, and there was two thoughts in my mind there, because there was a fine line between his mind, because he was very far over that line from sanity to insanity, but I also was so very close to crossing over that line myself. I mean, I don't know how I didn't. It affected me very, very badly. You know, I wouldn't go out. I wouldn't talk to people. I wouldn't eat. I wouldn't deal with things. I had no interest. I thought everybody was out to get me. You know, I didn't trust. The trust was absolutely terrible. I trusted no one. You know, you go out and you just think that there's something wrong with you, because you know what's happened, and you know that this. You blame yourself an awful lot. And you think, when you look in the mirror, you think you see a monster, you know. It's not what other people see, it's what you see in the mirror. And I didn't like me. I absolutely hated me. You know, I used to avoid mirrors because I didn't want to look. I didn't have them in the house. I didn't want to look at this image of what I thought was, you know, evil emanating from me. And I thought everybody else could see that. It's whether rational or irrational, when you're in a place that far down and you feel that way, people can tell you whatever, you know, they think you should hear, but it doesn't change, and it can't change until you come to a place within yourself where you realize that's not the case. You know, but it takes time. It took me a long time, but, you know, you get there.
Right. And along with all the mental abuse, was there sexual abuse as well?
Yeah, absolutely. The only thing that never happened with him was actual full sexual intercourse, because I always knew, I knew that didn't happen in my childhood. It was everything but that. You know, there's penetration, there was with his fingers, there was any other way you can think of a sexual act happened. It was never the full sort of sexual intercourse as penetration, as, you know, with his penis. As an adult, that was the same scenario, because I knew as an adult I would never go that far. I would sort of like put a gun to my own head before that happened. It was just that bit I had to hold back for me. And obviously at that point, when I was going through it as an adult, I didn't remember the childhood, you know, how it was then, until, you know, it was more or less over, which was 5 years in, as an adult, if you understand what I'm saying there. But, yeah, there was everything but full sexual intercourse. Yeah, that happened, yes.
Now, you said you left home at 16 to get away from all that. Did that continue after, you know, later as you became an adult with him, or with somebody else?
No, this was with him. I went to the RAF, yeah, I was 2 months after my 16th birthday. I came home, got married. I was then living back in the same town that my mother and he was, you know, my stepfather were living in. He then opened a business, and sort of it went on for about 5 years where it was all fine. And then he always told me, and I know maybe it was true because the business is no longer there, that the business was folding and it was in trouble. And at the very beginning, he sort of said to me, he got me to come work for him and got me to leave a job that I was happy in, basically by saying to me that the company was going under and, you know, he needed my expertise to stop that happening. So that was the start of get me into the office. I never realized, you know, where we were going to end up. If I had, I think I'd have got my car that day and driven 100 miles, you know, as fast as I could in the other direction. But that was just the starting point of it. And, yeah, it just got he just wanted more and more and more from me. It was just sometimes at the beginning it was working for him, then, you know, just go out for lunches because he needed to talk outside the office, and it just progressed into a situation where he was asking more and more from me, and I couldn't seem to stop him, you know. But the only way I could stop him would be to go and tell my mother, and I was unwilling to do that. I just couldn't do that to her, so I thought I could stop it. I thought I could get him back on the right side of sanity, and I thought I could do it on my own. And, okay, the only one that was hurting through that that point of time was me, and it had been me than my mother, so thinking I could control it, and it was just like a snowball, you know. It started at the top of the hill and it just kept rolling, and it kept rolling until I got to a point where I could no longer continue because I couldn't fight him anymore. So that's, as I say, the time I tried to take my own life, which sitting here today I would say is not the right thing to do, and there'll never be a repeat performance of that for me, because, well, I'm in a better place now, in a place where I can say that. But anyone out there listening, you know, you can find that place too. It's, you know, it's never too late to come back.
Right. And what would you tell women out here who are in that situation? Who would you tell them to reach out to, or what to do?
You know, it's a crazy thing, because it's all about forgiveness. You know, we all have the child within us. We all have. Doesn't matter how old we get, there's that child within us that can be scarred, it can be hurt, you know, and some people carry that through life. So the big thing is to realize you don't need this abuse in your life, that you can leave it, you know, put a place, something in place, a plan, where you can sort of get out of the situation. Excuse me. But the big thing is you have to learn to forgive. The one that's hard, you need to learn to forgive yourself and allow the child within you to heal, because, you know, you haven't done anything. This person has done it to you. You know, that's a major, major issue. But the harder one, you know, sometimes people say to me, oh, well, how can you say that? Is you have to learn to forgive your abuser. That is so, so very difficult, but it's something that you have to do, because, like, in my own case, my stepfather, I haven't seen him for 15 years now, and I was still dragging him along with me in my life by the scruff of the neck, because I wouldn't let go of the pain, and, you know, I was the one keeping him there. So both these things are something you have to do.
And you said your mother has passed on, right?
Yes, she passed on 5 years ago, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, sorry to hear that.
And do you think she really believed that? And how long before she died did she hear the truth, or what did she know about it?
Well, he just, one day he sort of, I said it was over, it was finishing, and I could do no more. I was in hospital at that time, having my stomach pumped, and I had to see a psychiatrist the next day, and that was the day I thought, you know, this, I can't do this, I've got to fight back. So I sort of said to him, do what you want to do now, because I can't stop you, I can't control this, and I cannot live anymore like this way. He then arranged for a holiday and took my mother away for a week. He arranged it to be in a cottage in the middle of nowhere where there was no landline phone and the cell phone wouldn't work. My mother couldn't drive. He sort of had her out in the middle of nowhere, got down on his knees. So the understanding of it, she told me after the fact, crying, and said that we had been having an affair for the last 5 years, and if she couldn't forgive him and take him back, then he was going to kill himself. He'd actually taken a gun and he was sitting there holding the gun. Mm. I mean, this man had guns within the house because he did a lot of private shooting, you know, and so he knew by taking her to that place she could get no help, you know, if he'd have shot himself. By the time, he said to her, by the time you get back, I'll be dead, you know, because you can't drive, there's no phone. And then she then rang me from a service station phone, and the first thing she said to me as I picked it up is, are you having an affair with your stepfather? I mean, and you could have knocked me over with a 10-ton truck, because I just couldn't believe. I really thought when I called his bluff that he, I mean, it was so far from the truth, it was, you know, not even believable. I mean, I knew the truth, but I thought by sort of getting that far down where, you know, I had tried to take my own life and sort of saying to him it's done, I didn't believe that he would then do what he said. But, I mean, he made me a promise 4 years previously that said if he couldn't have me, then I would lose everything and everyone I loved, and I would have nothing. And I suppose if I think about it now, that's the only thing in life he ever said to me and ever promised that he did. You know, and I did lose my family for many years. I lost my family for five years. We only actually, my siblings and myself, only actually sort of came to a situation where we could talk, where my mother was in hospital, you know, and she was on life support. So he carried out what he said. I mean, 2 years after he left, he wrote to my mother a very long letter saying that, telling her the truth, basically, what had actually had happened, my truth. But he'd already told everyone in my family his truth, you know. My mother said to me at that time, she would, you know, go around and talk to these people, tell them the truth, you know, and explain that what they heard was wrong. But at that point in my life, I didn't want to do so because it didn't matter anymore. You know, I'd been judged without sort of going to trial, if you can sort of put it that way, and it didn't matter anymore to put her through the fact of having to go and tell these people, you know, well, he's actually written to me and this is the truth, and I just told her to leave it. I mean, I know when she was in hospital that she did tell my siblings, but I wasn't aware of it until she was basically, you know, sort of so unwell that it didn't come up between us, because it was far more important that, you know, we were going to lose her.
And all the mental abuse, obviously, and one thing I need to go back and say too is that a lot of people that are abused don't know, or it's hard for them to differentiate the difference between shame versus guilt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're ashamed of what happened and we feel guilty. We feel that it's our fault.
Mm-hmm.
When in fact it's not really our fault. We're under control of somebody else, whether it's mental, physical, emotional, and so
yeah.
That's one thing that we need to you know, teach the young men and women about, is that the shame versus guilt, so that they can get over that maybe quicker.
Yeah. You do feel that, you know, but it's unwarranted, but it takes you a long time to get to that place. I mean, there are kids out there, I'm sure, you know, that have left home and are living on the streets. And I know, you know, I'm involved with Teens at Crossroads, and we're trying to raise funds to open a resource centre, both in America and in England, to get them off the streets. And I mean, these children have left their homes because they've been abused. And they, you know, they do blame themselves. They, there is that mix of shame. Was it my fault? You know, I was a bad person. If I'd been better, then this wouldn't have happened. But it's absolutely rubbish. It's, you know, there's no truth in that. You've been abused and you've been controlled by somebody who should have known better. You know, they're an adult and they got you into a situation that, you know, you should never have been in. And the blame and the fault lies at their own feet. It's not yours.
Right, and there's so many young kids nowadays. I just, you know, as a nurse, I see them younger and younger, you know, with depression and suicidal ideation and overdosing, and just, you know, their lives are in such turmoil at such young ages. It's hard to understand sometimes why. And I, you know, I look at them and I just imagine everything, you know, as, you know, we talk on our shows about, but I always, you know, wonder what is really going on in their life, you know, to make them feel so depressed and so sad and so hopeless, you know.
And
I always wonder, you know, are they being, you know, physically abused or mentally abused, or, you know, mm-hmm. and you know, it's just really sad to see.
They become isolated. You become very insular. This is the thing, because you think you do feel you're doing something wrong. I know I did as a child. I just thought it was my fault. If I could be better, if I could be a better child, or if I was to, you know, clean my bedroom, or if I was to offer to do the shopping or things like that, that it, you know, then that would make a difference. But that's also an untruth. You know, it's not about what you're doing. It's being done to you by an adult who should know better, an adult who wants you to feel that way, because then the guilt's put to you. And, you know, you're young, you know, and you don't know why these things are happening. And it's so very difficult to try and think, well, this person is supposed to love me. They're supposed to protect me, and they're not doing that. And, you know, your mind wanders, and depression is bound to happen. And for the, and you're right, these kids out there, they are getting that way. They are depressed. They are suicidal, you know, they, because they don't know what to do to make it better. But it's not for them to make it better. It's for other people to make it better, you know. So, and you get this thing, well, if you tell someone, then, you know, you're going to, they'll take you in a home, or, you know, you'll be put away and they won't believe you. And that's not true either. You know, you've got to, if you're out there listening, you have to go to somebody that you trust and tell them, you know, because you are not to blame. This person is controlling your life. This person is the evil one. It's not you. You need to go get somebody you trust, talk to them, and get out of that situation.
And then again, like you said, it's so hard to trust when you're constantly, you know, even if you don't know any better and you can't control it, but you feel so low and ashamed and I guess depressed sometimes. But, you know, like you said, it's hard to trust anybody.
Absolutely.
And,
this is the thing. This is the thing that, you know, it's the hold, you know, at the sort of the back of your neck, because the people you think you can trust, that should be your parents, or if it's your uncle or whatever that's abusing you, you think family members are the people that you should trust. And how can you trust anybody that isn't a family member? You know, if you can't trust them, who can you trust out there? And it's really, really difficult to know that. I mean, even as an adult, I found it very difficult to find a psychiatrist that I could open up to, as I explained earlier, to trust her to be able to say, you know, to deal with my own demons then. And it's not easy. It's not going to be easy. And, you know, I can't sit here and say it will be, because it isn't, you know. But you can, it can happen. You can come back from these things. You know, it's just one step at a time. That becomes a stride. You know, the hill, the mountain becomes a hill. And things can alter over a period of time. It's just sort of trying to get the strength within you to do it. You know, because when you're down as low as there is possibly, you're possibly able to go, there's a one way to go, and that's up. And it doesn't matter how long it takes you to go to sort of climb that hill. As long as you sort of make a step towards it, you will get there. And there are people out there you can trust. You just need to go to the right people. Go to the doctor, your doctor. Go to the police. Go to somebody that, you know, you think are in a profession that you can trust, because they are in a job of trust.
Right. And do you feel that, I mean, I always think, you know, we only know what we learn and what we're taught as we grow up, and sometimes kids are abused, and to them that's maybe normal because that's all they know. What do you feel about that?
I'm sorry, the phone broke up then, Cindy. I couldn't hear you. Could you repeat that, please?
As far as kids that grow up in an abusive relationship, but as children, all we know is what we're taught, you know, as we grow up. So for those that are being abused, and that's all they know, so they don't really know that it's wrong or different.
No, that's true, I suppose. But I guess in another way they do, because you... I think I do a lot of volunteer work now, and I go into groups and I talk to people and youngsters in England. And I think you do know, because there is something, they act differently. This is why it's sort of difficult to understand why. What, you know, people say to me, "Well, did your mother know?" This is not just me. This is like children who are abused. Did their mother know? Did the other person in the family know? If it, you know, and I think what I did was to try and hide within myself. I wanted to become invisible, because if I was invisible, then this couldn't happen to me. And I think now, as I see, you know, people in groups that I attend, I think you can see the child does know, because they act differently. They probably don't know why they're acting differently, and do they think their other siblings are being abused? But it, you know. It's very, yeah, you're right. They could think it's the right thing to do, and that it's, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. But ultimately, there is. And this is why people like yourselves and me and other people within this sort of realm of reaching out need to get to them and to sort of get into their heads that it isn't right, you know. This is a message we all have to be trying to get out there.
Definitely. I'm going to turn the mic over to Boyd for a minute. We do have a caller on the line, and we will get to them here in just a minute. Boyd?
All right, Dan. I'm just sitting here vibing and listening to everything, and I just want to say, you know, I definitely commend you for coming out and telling your story, not only to help yourself, but to help others as well against this violence out here in the world. And I just wanted you to give your website any information you got where they can go purchase your book as well.
Okay. The main thing now, Paul, is helping others, because I'm in a place of peace now. I can deal with what happened to me now. My passion now, and I spend hours a day doing it, is to reach out to those that haven't, you know, climbed that ladder. So that's my mission.
Amen. And do you have a website where people can go purchase your book?
Yeah, well, you can purchase my book on Amazon. It's on Kindle. It's, as it says, it's Teresa Joyce, and that's spelled T-E-R-E-S-A-J-O-Y-C-E. My website is www.teresajoyce.com, so really it's teresajoyce.com. It's quite easy to remember. My publishers are Chipmunker Publishing, who are one of the world's biggest mental health care publishers, and on my site there is an icon with their name there, which if you click on that, it would take you straight to their site to purchase the book that way, so it's a direct link.
All right, that sounds great right there. And for a lot of women and people that's going through what you went through, what advice would you give them that's still trapped in that cycle?
They have to break the cycle. And I know that sounds, you know, people listening out there probably thinking when I say that, you know, I can't, or it's not that easy. I know it isn't, but I know you can, you know, because I'm here and I'm thinking, you can, and you can. So you need to absolutely believe in yourself, because I believe in you. You know, the people out there that will. People like yourselves doing these shows, they believe in you. You know, it can happen. You just have to sort of take a deep breath and go, you know, and do it. Because how long do you want to stay within the situation? You know, you have a life. They have no, that person has no right to control, mess up your life, and treat you where you are. You know, you can do it. That's the message I want to get out there. You can. It absolutely can happen.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, as far as being blackmailed like you were and, you know, threatened that they, you know, he would hurt other people, you know, that's got to be scary for someone to go for help, thinking that, you know, maybe mom or dad or sister or brother, somebody will be hurt, maybe killed because, you know, because I need help.
Yeah, absolutely.
So how do you get through that?
Well, I got through that because I got to a point in my life where I could no longer continue on. And as I said, I tried to take my own life, which I'm hoping we can get out to these people that are, you know, in the situation and listening, that they do, you know, they get out before you come to that point. I mean, it's not a place you ultimately want to go. But, you know, eventually you get to a point where you know there's nowhere else to go. And I knew in the end that this guy, because of the stories that are within my book, which if you read the book you would fully understand, it came to a point where I knew his threats became threats, and I had to realize in my head the change. They were very real for me for very many, you know, for 4 or so years. I believed he would do. And I think I got to a place where I knew that he wouldn't, because I knew that he was far more selfish than he was, you know, putting out there. I mean, he sat in the office one day and told me he was going to kill himself with a shotgun in his mouth if I didn't leave with him. And at that point, I was about, I don't know, 3-4 months before the actual time where I did try to take my life. And I just said, well, just do it, you know, shoot yourself. And he sort of, because my mindset started to change. I mean, at that point, he sort of said, no, it's not that easy, you know. And I said, well, then shoot me, because I got to that point where it was easier to be out than to deal with. And I think everyone does get to that point where you realize that there has to be a turning point where, and that's different for everybody. And there is the guilt. There is the, you know, he did terrible things, or he threatened terrible things for people that I loved, you know. But there is a turning point in everyone's lives where you get to it and you think, I can't do this anymore. You know, and we hopefully get to these people that before they get to the sort of where I went, so that they realize they need to do something about it before then.
Now, my question is, talking about breaking the cycle, and I don't know if you know anything about his past or what made him become like that, but do you know anything? Did his parents or somebody in his life abuse him? And, I mean, if so, did you know anything about that?
No, I'm absolutely sure that he didn't. You know, I mean, it's quite strange because on my website, as I said, teresajoyce.com, I do a lot of articles there. And I've had two or three emails now from abusers asking me questions, and I thought it was quite strange at first. I wondered why that some of that elk would be on a website of mine, which is about abuse, you know, and about mental health care. And I chose to write an article on there about that. It's probably one of the, I think it was been on there about a week now, where it's called Abusers at Abuse. And I chose to sort of answer their question, really. Why do they abuse? And, you know, so many people say, and you're quite right, well, you know, abusers have been abused. And that's true, I'm sure, in lots of cases, but that's not always the case. You know, people who are abused don't always go on to abuse. And that's, you know, that doesn't make it right. You know, if I was abused, I would never dream of abusing my son or my daughter.
Right, right.
You know, some people that are abused, but that's not, you know, it's not everyone. And, you know, at the end of the piece I wrote on my website, I actually said to them, you know, if you're here and you're reading this, then maybe you've made the choice to stop what you're doing for yourself, you know, so then do it. And I'm hoping that is the case. They've come there for sort of to change the way that they're behaving, because I can't really sort of think why else they would come to a site like mine and actually email me the emails that they did, which are obviously, I'll keep personal because they were sent to me as a personal email. But I'm hoping by the fact they were there that maybe they've come to a point in their life where they know they're doing wrong. And if I can reach out to those people as well, then, you know, that's absolutely fantastic.
Definitely. Because they do need help as well.
Absolutely, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go ahead and take this call here. We have somebody here with a 770 area code.
Hey, y'all. It's Lisa.
Hey, Lisa.
Hey, y'all, what y'all getting
into?
Welcome
to the show.
You know I come hard with this one. Hey, Miss Teresa, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. Yourself?
I'm blessed.
Okay.
I was actually in a situation. My father, I was never sexually abused by my family, but my mother hated me from the day I turned two and told me every day she wished I was an abortion. She's dead, don't care. My father always tried to protect me, but when he would come home, he would hear so much lies about me, he would have to beat me with the belt. I mean, I got scars and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But the final time was when my mother, she lied so much on me, and I was 4 years old and got beat so bad by my father and got put in a closet, and my grandmother came and rescued me. She found me bloody, like straight blood from head to toe. So then, okay, I was good. You know, I went and lived with my grandma, my best friend, and then got married at 19. That didn't work out, but that's all right. I got the princess out of that one. And me and him still friends. He on wife number 5 after me. But then I met my little one's father, and that's where the abuse began on our honeymoon.
Mm-hmm. Was this physical abuse? Okay.
This is my little one. She'll be 12 in December, and what he did to me for 2 years. Like you said, the control, you can't go nowhere, you can't call nobody, you can't do nothing without them. It wasn't my father, but it was my husband.
Mm-hmm.
Took me from my whole family. But after 2 years, I finally got out, or so I thought. After my teeth was knocked out, stabbed, and the stories I could tell you. But this ain't my show, this is yours. But just to know that I survived, and I do my domestic violence shows on Sundays, year round. I'm actually on hiatus again until January because I got so much going on for the event and everything, but that's another here or there. But knowing that we can help each other, and when I heard about what Robin Lucinda was doing, the streets don't love you back, never hit a woman. Like, I promote that because there is no reason. It's not even never hit a woman. It's never hit anybody. Because I've actually had men call into my domestic violence show that are being mentally abused. And that's the other thing. The physical scars, yeah, they heal. They sure do heal. It's the mental ones and the nightmares that you got to wake up to in the middle of the night.
Absolutely, yeah. I'm right with you there. I've got an article on my website about the nightmares. And, yeah, that's the one that's really difficult. I mean, how did you actually get away from it in the end? Did you find the strength to leave?
Yeah, his parents helped me.
Okay.
His parents and his sister, because I wasn't allowed around my family. They didn't even know what was going on in Florida. Okay. And I will never forget crawling out in the parking lot from my house from being almost choked to death. And then there was a time after the baby was born, I had moved back up to Jersey. His mama dropped me off. That's a whole nother story. But I remember being hit over the head. And the next thing I know, I woke up 4 days later out of a coma from him. Mm-hmm. He had found out where I lived. So, it's just so mentally abusive. It, like I said, it's the emotional and mental. It's not the physical because the scars all healed. I mean, I got scars, yeah. I got to get my teeth fixed, but yeah. But I can do all that with money. But you can't take the emotional away. You can't take the mental away. Because at the end of the night, you gotta worry about if he's going to find me again.
Yeah, and you actually do. You know, when my stepfather left, I used to sort of go out for many a year and think, you know, he could be there, he could be following me. Does he know where I now live? Because I'd moved from where he knew I was living. And it's, you know, you live in dread or fear, you know, and you're sort of looking over your shoulder all the time, which is no way to live. But, I mean, you know, I'm really sort of happy you got out of that situation. And it's people like you and myself, and there are others out there that are advocates to say, you know, we have come through this, we've done this, and you can do it too.
Yeah, they can. But here's the problem. They'd be so scared, like you said, because I've been listening to the show the whole time. I called in only 5 minutes late, but I've been listening and doing stuff around the house. But something you said, we're scared.
Mm-hmm.
Because he threatened to kill me, he threatened to kill my oldest daughter, he threatened to kill his own mother and father and sister because they had my back and not his.
Mm-hmm.
So I understand that whole point, but sometimes you got to realize, like, it's time to go. And if you don't go because you're scared, get your kids out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I stress this on my domestic violence show, get the kids out, because guess what? At the end of the day, it's the kids that are the victims. We're victims, mm-hmm. but the kids are really, really, really the victims because they see this, they witness it, and like we said, okay, well, hold up. Daddy was sitting on mommy, or mommy was abusing daddy, whichever the fact was. Okay, vice versa. I could do it too. Because that's how I was brought up. Because us kids, we're a product of our environment. And I broke the cycle. I did break the cycle because I've never put my hands on my kids. That's a lie. I can't even lie. The little one, I spanked her butt when she ran out in front of a car.
Right.
Yeah. And the oldest one, I blacked both her eyes when she was 17, when I was at the bar, and I'm like 32, like, okay, I'm good, I'm in the bar, I'm having fun with my friends, and she gonna call me screaming at me. She couldn't get me on my phone. She called my boyfriend's phone and said, you better tell mommy to get home. He said, it's 9 o'clock, she just got here. Oh, well, I need her to come home. Okay, so I get in the house with her, and she gonna start fighting me. Are you serious? You're 17 years old? Okay, let's go. But otherwise than that, I never would ever put my hands on no kids.
No. Well, no, it shouldn't happen.
There's so many people that don't understand that either, you know, that we have to continually be that loud voice to spread that message. And one thing I wanted to iterate tonight on the show is that it's so many people in government and different places talking about they waging war on drugs. I mean, we've been past that because we can't never beat that game because the government controls that, so they can stop talking about that. We need to wage war on this domestic violence and start making that aware every day, not just in October. That's what we need to continuously wage war on, that right there, helping save lives.
Yeah, absolutely.
And bro, Rob, you already know, I get real mad. And first of all, Teresa, something you got to know about me, I'm an avid football fan.
Mm-hmm.
I love football, but I get really pissed, because I'm going to cuss. You're going to find out about me, too, that during the month of October, it's breast cancer awareness, but it's also domestic violence awareness. So
mm-hmm.
all the football players are wearing the pink. Why is nobody wearing purple?
Mm-hmm.
I want answers to that.
I'm starting to see things now with purple, and even though it's still breast cancer, they're making it purple with pink ribbon. You know, and I'm like, wait a minute, purple's for anti-violence, knock it off.
exactly. Lucinda, you ain't never lied, and I get so aggravated, and I talk about it on my show, they're like, calm down. No. So what I did was I inboxed Andy Reid. I sent an email to the Eagles, because that's my favorite team, like, come on now, can y'all do some? Nobody
mm-hmm.
ever answered me. Really?
Right.
But,
Yeah, like we said, once again, you know, nobody wants to really stand up and make a difference in the domestic violence towards our women and kids. But, you know, for many years and to this day, they can constantly keep coming out, even when they're running for office. You constantly hear the same speech, oh, we got to get all the drugs off the street. We all warging war on drugs, but you don't hear not one time in these campaigns out here that we need to, once again, raise war on domestic violence towards our women and kids. You know, we don't hear that, period, in these campaigns. And we have to be the voice. We have to speak up. We have to stand tall and start speaking out about these issues, you know. 1 month is not just about domestic violence. Every day is domestic violence awareness to me.
Mm-hmm.
Every
right.
single
and again,
day.
Too, we don't want to call it a war on violence, because that is what violence is. I mean, war is violence, and we know the war on drugs only, hurt our own people. It was a war on our own people. We don't want it to be a war. We want it to be a campaign or, education, but a zero tolerance for domestic violence, for any kind of violence. Too many people are losing their lives. Too many people are dying. Too many people are hurting. Too many people are in pain. And it just needs to be a zero tolerance for any kind of violence.
And there's so many judges out here that's not paying attention to nothing, period. You know what I mean? When it comes to the domestic violence, but they will pay close attention to a drug case in a minute. They will sit on the bench and listen to that out. But a woman coming to courtroom, head half beat off, paperwork in order, where this guy done definitely did this crime, and they get tired of seeing that in the courtroom. But they hit the hammer on a first-time drug offender and get him natural life. But the knucklehead monster, he like a revolving door. Domestic violence class in 90 days, you know. So we have to speak out about that, and we... You know, really, I want to cut out the domestic violence classes and all of that. You feel me? If you straight up guilty for doing this crime toward these women and kids, you know, like a drug dealer get life, you need to get life too. I mean, it's no in between with me, period, you know?
Okay, now, wait, hold up, Rob. Now, let me come at you with something. Do you realize the things that I post up? And I know you and Lucinda do. Teresa, you're going to find out about me. But... I post up that breast cancer awareness, okay, is an epidemic, a growing epidemic. It kills you, just like domestic violence can kill you.
Exactly.
Just like the drugs can kill you.
Right.
So you got three of them, that we all trying to battle. I mean, I'm not battling none of them anymore, but I'll represent them. But at the same time, my ex-husband, he was a crackhead that beat me. So I was in both worlds. I was in both worlds. He was a crackhead that beat me that, you know, like I said, that's neither here nor there right now. But it's the same point. It's they all epidemics, and they growing harder and harder in the U.S. And then we got our little kids out there, with, oh, my God, with the guns, the 12 and 13-year-olds that pick up the guns, get trigger-happy, just shoot somebody for no damn reason. And I'm an OG to the street. Everybody knows that. Triple OG to Newark. Newark, shout-out, I love you. But do you know why I'm afraid to go back to my own hometown? Because of all the drama that's going on over there and all the killings. And it's just, it doesn't make no sense. And like Tony and me, I mean, not Tony, me, Rob, Lucinda, and Tanisha, we all say the same thing. The streets don't love you back because the bullet ain't got no name.
Amen.
So, and then you got these women that get restraining orders, which are just a piece of paper. Just a piece of paper. Because
and,
at the end
the
of the day.
And the mom still come back and kill the woman and the kids. He ain't
exactly.
paid no attention to no papers.
Exactly. That monster
you
will come back.
Monster, yeah. When you know this monster is guilty and you know this monster is doing what he's doing, his ass needs to be in jail once again. It's wrong to sell drugs, but the drug man shouldn't be getting life in the penitentiary on the first time of offense. And this man is studied like a revolving door, beating women and all day long, and he right back on the street chilling. I mean, we have to campaign that real hard because if we don't campaign that, you gotta believe ain't none of these officials out here gonna campaign. You can believe.
Well,
that.
You have to be really careful too with the domestic violence because a lot of time the abuser turns things around and makes the other one look like the abuser. And so, you know, if you were to go to court and the judge was to be that tough, the wrong person might be put away, you know, and it happens all the time. We know it does, you know. And then
Lucinda,
to a point when it happens over and over, the judge just doesn't want to hear about it anymore. They're tired of seeing you, and we know that too.
Lucinda, you already know. Miss Teresa, listen to this story. No lie. I'm in my crib with my child, with my oldest one, the princess. She doing her homework. I'm cooking dinner. I'm 8 months pregnant. Okay. Next thing I know, I get a knock at the door. Well, who knows where I live? Like, for real. So I get a knock at the door. I'm thinking it's somebody selling something. I open the door. It's the sheriff's officers. They had, they had a warrant of removal for me from my own crib. I'm looking at these sheriff's office like, excuse me? They said, you have to leave your apartment, your townhouse. I'm like, wait a minute, why? Well, Mr. Perry... Now, I was still legally married, but we were separated. He didn't even know where I was, but he once again found out where I was. This man actually went to the court that I lived in, told them I threatened to kill him, and that he lived with me. Lived with me. And me and my child got put out. So now I had to hand over my keys to my townhouse that I'm the only one on the lease with the babies. They knew I was pregnant, you know, so we put the future baby on there. And my princess. And no lie, I had to get out. And my court date wasn't for 7 days. And I'm trying to show the sheriffs, look at the lease. He's nowhere on here. He doesn't stay here. He doesn't get me out. Well, ma'am, you know, we're just doing our job. You have to leave. What? So they give us 15 minutes to pack up a week's worth of clothes. I had to shut the food off. I will never forget this. And I had to go to his mother's house. I called her. I was crying. I said, Mommy, she's like, what's wrong? I said, I just got served a restraining order, and I had to get out of my house. She said, come to the house. You just stay here. We get there. We go to court the following Thursday. I went off on the judge, almost went into jail, which I've been there before, but almost went into jail behind a contempt of court for screaming at the judge so loud, why you didn't check your records. I've got a restraining order on him. In every state I've been in. And now you didn't even check. You just issued him a restraining order, gave him the keys to my apartment. I got puppies in there. Like, what were you thinking? oh, my God, Miss Perry, apologies from the court, this, that, and third. His own mother testified, like, she ain't been with him, she been hiding. That's our daughter-in-law, and she's expecting 8 months pregnant, fat as hell in the jail. I'm just like, oh, my God. So the next thing I said to the judge, I said, can I have my...
Right.
Hello?
He's there.
Yeah, I'm here. Oh, okay. I'm running my mouth as usual. His parents took me back to my crib with my child, and we walked in, and everything that could have been sold for crack was gone, including the puppies. Enough said.
Yeah, so that's a real another tragedy in itself right there, you know. So we're going to ask you, Ms. Teresa, do you have any last words you would like to talk about? And I would like for you to give the viewers your website once again and go cop that book. It's a good learning lesson in the book and hope you got some good knowledge out of this message tonight. So give them that website again, Ms. Teresa.
Okay, it's teresajoyce.com, and it's spelled TERESAJOYCE.com. The book's called There's a Fine Line, Amazon, Kindle, or if you go direct to my website, Chipmunker Publisher, on my publishers, there's the name there written on the front page. If you click on that, it'll take you straight to the store if you're interested in the book.
And tonight, Ms. Teresa, did you want the viewers to get out of your message tonight?
To learn to forgive themselves, to learn to forgive their abuser. But if I could share sort of with you something quite quickly here. I was on a radio show a couple of weeks ago, and I had somebody ring me in from the state penitentiary. Actually, it was not ringing. It was a chat. They were on the chat line there and asked me a question. And this is the reason that we have to learn to forgive and move on, because this lady had seen her mother abused for years and years and years physically. She was sexually abused by her father. She carried this on with her for 10 years in life, couldn't forgive herself, couldn't move on, couldn't do anything to forgive him. She went and bought a gun and she shot him. She took his life, you know. And now she's, doing life in prison. And, you know, that is such a message to say this person was still controlling her life. She couldn't, you know, he abused her as a child. I don't, you know, defend the fact she took a life. I couldn't obviously do so. But, you know, she lost her childhood to him, and now she'd lost the rest of her life through her own actions. So there's no rights or wrongs in amongst all that. But, you know, deal with it. Do something before it deals with you and takes over your life. You really have to get out there and sort of try and move on and forgive yourself. Forgive that person, the perpetrator, because, you know, you allow them to still be there. They will control you forever. They don't have to be there to do that. And forgiving is not forgetting. It's a different word.
Right.
Amen. Amen to that, you know.
Okay.
And I'm going to turn it over to my missus and we have any last announcements before I speak again?
We just want to let everybody remind you to join us at our website, thestreetsdontwantyoubackname.com. We have our books out still, The Streets Don't Want You Back and Never Hit a Woman. We will be speaking here in Maricopa to the high school on November 23rd. In December, we will be going to Rialto, San Bernardino, California, and Compton area. We're speaking at a school out there and also doing a book signing. And we know for March we'll be in Atlanta. We are going to be hitting up Detroit, New York, New Jersey. Again, here we're just trying to get our schedule all mapped out for 2012. If you'd like to have us in your city, give us an email. Let's get something set up. You know, as we go out tonight, we're going to dedicate the closing song when we do close out here in a minute, Guide and Protect Us, to our brother Sydney, who was buried today. He was killed last week in a drive-by shooting, a direct result of a domestic violent relationship that didn't have anything to do with him, but he was caught in the crossfire. So we definitely know that domestic violence kills, that kills a lot of innocent people, and we need to not tolerate that anymore. We need to teach our young children from day one, you know, and in school they need to have programs teaching the, you know, kids, you know, not to tolerate that. They need to know what's right and wrong, and, you know, it just needs to be taught, just like everything else. Boyd?
All right. Yeah, I would just like to say in my last words, I definitely thank God for having me had the pleasure of meeting my brother for first time in September. And, you know, I did have a chance to meet him. I had never met him a day in my life. I had never knew about him until our father passed March 16th of this year. And I found that I had all these brothers and sisters. And I just thank God that I did have a chance to meet him in September. Me and my missus went to Michigan and met him. And it's a tragic that a month later he's dead. So that right there has done made me push real hard with the Streets Don't Love You Back movement and expressing that message to the youngsters and the oldest and, you know, just everybody across the nation because, you know, all that kills, you know what I mean? Domestic violence kills. It might not kill you, but it'll take somebody's life and your family that ain't had nothing to do with anything. So we have to be very careful on the moves we make, the things we do, the choices we make, and we have to be careful on what we say, how we say it, and when we say it. So with all that being said, we would like to just thank everybody for tuning in tonight and thanking Mr. Reese for calling in all the way from London, England. Thank you, Ms. Lisa, for being on the show tonight as well. And we'd just like to send a big shout-out to the whole Daniel family. And we're definitely right there with you in your morning. And we're just asking everybody to just be safe and keep God first.
That's right. And we're going to go out tonight with the song Guide and Protect Us by Rising Sun. And thank you, Teresa, for coming on and being a gracious guest and for sharing your life with us. Once again, visit her website at www.teresajoyce.com. And you can also find out about what other radio shows that she's on. She's also helping with a teen radio show as well. So check out her website, find out what she's up to, get her book, It's a Fine Line, and let's empower people out here to know the truth about domestic violence, and let's put that zero tolerance right out in front and stop violence.
Oh, yeah, I just want to ask Ms. Teresa before we get off the phone, have you added your book to our book club on our movement page, Ms. Teresa?
No, I haven't. There's lots of things in the month, so I still need to get done. But it's, you know, lots of things in the pipeline, and I'm going to get around to doing so.
Great.
Okay, sounds good. Yeah, sounds great. Well, hey, we appreciate it, and we know it's morning time over there almost, and you have a great day off work, and once again, we appreciate your time, and we appreciate you spreading your message also to help save lives. So God bless, and everybody have a great night.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me there.
Thank you. And we're going to go out with Guide and Protect Us. Join us next Wednesday night, 11:30 Eastern Time, and still 8:30 Pacific. Have a great week, and remember, the streets don't love you back.
Guide and protect us, Lord. Give us your grace and your strength and your mercy, swinging that two-edged sword. I'm fighting for justice so nothing can hurt me, even when I pass away. My legacy lives on through my seed and my working, every little thing I pray. Give thanks to your grace and your strength and your mercy, the first one. one I call every day when I wake and pray. Yeah, the one who is there when no one has a care, I say, Lord, you strengthen my soul when my mind wants to go astray. Yeah, and lift me up high when I fall and my ground gives way. Lord, how precious your love and your grace and your countenance. Your grace and your strength and your mercy, swinging the two-edged sword. I'm fighting for justice, so nothing can hurt me, even when I pass away. My legacy lives on through my seed and my working, every little thing I pray. Give thanks to your grace and your strength and your mercy. With enemies close all around, I will call your name. Yeah, and slaughter the weak, you quickly. With no thought or shame, Lord, for my heart is firm in your hands, so I'm no disgrace. No, I'll hail up your name every day with a smiling face. Boy, I never can give enough praise to your tenderness, Lord. To be in your infinite grace is my happiness. Yeah, no matter the time or the you're omnipotent, Lord. You show me the light and the dark, so I shall repent. Guide and protect us, Lord. To give us your grace and your strength and your mercy, swinging the two-edged sword. I'm fighting for justice, so nothing can hurt me, even when I pass away. My legacy lives on through my seed and my working, every little thing I pray. Give thanks to your grace and your strength and your mercy, yeah. We tread the long rocky road, the buffalo soldier fights the power, freedom, war. The last step on the throne, the conquering disciples, burn your congregation, yeah. Collect your security, we build a better nation, time beside the unity. Say nothing in fight, nothing in war, but brotherly love can destroy oppression. If we come together, we can conquer all our foes. Live victory eternally. But if we keep on murdering, see so much petty things, we're crumbling our destiny. But we were meant to rule upon the earth and multiply creativity and love. So I will always strive to show love and respect until I die. And so I will humble and pray. Guide and protect us, Lord. Give us your grace and your strength and your mercy, swinging the two-edged sword. I'm fighting for justice, so nothing can hurt me, even when I pass away. My legacy lives on through my seed and my working, every little thing I pray. Give thanks to your grace and your strength and your mercy,